Welcome to the Damage Report. It's Friday. Let's close out the week right. We've got some big topics to cover today on the show. We're going to be talking about climate change to start off the show, but not just climate change in particular. Climate change and misogyny. What is the connection between those two things? It's actually far more fascinating than you might think. We're going to take a look at a number of different studies and see what we can learn from that. I'm going to take it back a little bit later in the show to 1992, a speech by Bernie Sanders about military spending that I came across that is just amazing. And then we're going to update the numbers he uses in the speech a little bit. Take a look at what's happened in the years since 1992. Along the way, we're going to have an awesome candidate joining us, former Andrew Yang staffer Jonathan Herzog is going to join us on the show. We're going to talk about that. We've got Ken Klippenstein and his most recent reporting on private prisons. And then we're going to close out the show with a little bit of an online scuffle between Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Laura Ingraham. That's going to be at least a little bit of fun. So you're going to want to stick around for that. But first, the climate change. Let's start off there. When you think about those who are leading the conversation on climate change, both here in the United States and around the world, who are some of the names that immediately leap to mind? Here, you probably think of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the Green New Deal. Abroad, you've got Greta Thunberg, a 16-year-old activist who has done so much already in Europe. And then there's the activists. You've got the Sunrise Movement and Varshini Prakash, friend of the show. It turns out that in this area, a lot of the people who are making the most news and making the most progress are women. And it's been interesting to see the response to these women. How do the foes of dealing with climate change treat them? Well, for some of these, you're probably familiar. You know that with AOC, for instance, Fox News, in a 6-week period, they mentioned her 3,000 times. I think that's 67, 71 times a day, something like that. I'm not a mathematician, but man, she really got under their skin. And she still does. She did an Instagram story recently about decarbonization and what needs to be done for climate change. And take a look at just the very beginning of an ad that a right-wing Twitter account put out targeting AOC.
Shallow Thoughts with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
You think overhauling our economy to decarbonize and save the planet is going to be expensive? Try not decarbonizing our economy.
And it goes on like that for about a minute. The thing about it is, there's no shallow thoughts in it. It's a cogent argument about why we need to deal with climate change, done completely, no prompter, no notes or anything. She just spoke about it intelligently. And I think that they're trying to reference Deep Thoughts with Jack Handy. I don't think that they understood that sketch, but it is comedy and they are right wingers. Now, I wouldn't have even played that if she had not responded to it. She tweeted, "I love everything about this GOP attack ad. Republicans underestimate my intelligence because I invite people into my home and talk about policy in plain English instead of DC jargon. They think that's dumb, so they end up paying for ads that spread and explain our policy positions." And that's all it does. It's just a minute of her speaking about the topic, you know, with empathy and intelligence, but that drives them insane. Something about her, moving from AOC over to Greta Thunberg, she's been targeted for months and months now in increasingly insane and even violent fashion in terms of the rhetoric. So she sailed over from Europe to the US, an impressive feat for anyone, let alone a 16-year-old. And on her first day of sailing, a multimillionaire Brexit activist tweeted that he wished a freak accident would destroy her boat. A conservative Australian columnist called her, quote, "a deeply disturbed messiah of the global warming movement." While the British far-right activist David Vance attacked the sheer petulance of this arrogant child. Former Trump staffer Steve Malloy recently called Thunberg a, quote, "teenage puppet." While a widely shared far-right meme showed Trump tipping the Statue of Liberty to crush her boat. Because if a 16-year-old disagrees with you on policy, she should be murdered by the president of the United States. That's the oddly violent and extreme reaction that these female climate activists can expect. And not just the activists, by the way, even if you're just a scientist, not particularly in the public eye, you better watch out. Look at this recent article talking about, as climate scientists speak out, sexist attacks are on the rise. Female researchers have faced everything from personal insults to death and rape threats. They're just the researchers. They're running statistical analyses, they're testing water samples and things like that, testing air quality. And even they are being attacked. So why is this? Why this insane reaction to these women on climate change? Well, it turns out there's actually quite a bit of research on why misogynists attack these women in particular so much. So I'm gonna refer to some research saying for climate skeptics, it was not the environment that was threatened. This is an analysis of the language they use. It was a certain kind of modern industrial society built and dominated by their form of masculinity. And going far, this is researcher Martin Holtman who said, there is a package of values and behaviors connected to a form of masculinity that I call industrial breadwinner masculinity. They see the world as separated between humans and nature. They believe humans are obliged to use nature and its resources to make products out of them. And they have a risk perception that nature will tolerate all types of waste. It's a risk perception that doesn't think of nature as vulnerable and as something that is possible to be destroyed. For them, economic growth is more important than the environment. So I have talked about climate change more than the vast majority of people in media. And in all of this time, I never once thought that my manhood was being threatened by doing something about carbon concentration in the atmosphere, which actually in hindsight seems like a reasonable thing to have overlooked in that time. But for climate denialists, for climate skeptics, this is very much on their mind. Climate science in general, Martin Holtman continues, has become feminized or viewed as quote, oppositional to assumed entitlements of masculine primacy. And then look, you can go even further than this and you can look at research in particular. This is the sort of research, by the way, that back when I was in grad school, I used to do, where you show people images or you read them a bit of text and you see how they respond. How does it change their views of a topic in comparison to some sort of control group? Now take a look at these. In one experiment, participants of both sexes described an individual who brought a reusable canvas bag to the grocery store as more feminine than someone who used a plastic bag, regardless of whether the shopper was a male or female. So in this experiment, it affected both men and women. Regardless of whether it was a man or a woman who was holding the reusable bag, people saw them as more feminine because the carrying container they used was one material rather than another. I've watched some of those old school movies where like they have like the strong male characters. What, did they use plastic bags a lot? Was that a trope that I missed growing up? I'm not sure. In another experiment, participants perceived themselves to be more feminine after recalling a time when they did something good versus bad for the environment. So if you make a person think about cleaning up garbage, you know, in a field, they will think of themselves as more feminine. Now, that is not just some sort of natural objective truth of the environment. Something in the popular culture has led them to associate doing right by the environment with being more feminine. But at this point, at least, I have no idea what it was. I mean, Captain America was a guy. That effect, maybe he's been out of like circulation for too long. Maybe they need to reboot the series. But honestly, I cannot think of anything that makes caring about climate change and protecting our species from a massive threat, potential extinction, certainly a million species as the UN reported last year, at threat of extinction due in no small part to climate change. Nothing about that seems particularly feminine to me or particularly masculine. It has nothing to do with gender roles whatsoever. But honestly, if we want to appeal to these bizarre, sad figures who think that they're gonna lose their manhood if they do something about, like if they use an electric car or something, honestly, think back to literally any other threat historically that we have had to face. If you know, we're still living in the savanna, we've just barely come down from the trees and there's an animal in the bushes. That threat was there, you would address it, right? You wouldn't simply lay down as some threat to you and your community was developing. You wouldn't do that, right? Okay, so a jaguar, if there was a foreign military about to invade, you'd do something about it, right? So why is it that when it's the ocean rising, when it's heat levels rising, when it's our agriculture being threatened, when it's our access to water being threatened, why are those threats not enough to trip your bizarre old school form of masculine need to protect yourself and those you care about? This threat is every bit as real and far larger than any of those threats that I just cited. And for some reason, For some reason, it's considered not masculine to do something about that. I got news for you. There's nothing masculine about scientific ignorance. There's nothing masculine about allowing corporations, fossil fuel companies, to make as much money as possible while they despoil our environment. There's nothing masculine about sticking your head in the sand as the conditions arise that will lead to civil wars, wars between states, resource wars, mass migrations of people. There's nothing masculine about letting young and old die during heat waves every year in increasing numbers, or at least nothing that I've been able to notice. And look, the lack of action is bad enough, but the insane, misogynistic, violent, and sexual threats against female climate activists, that is where it gets even scarier. And the thing is, in misogyny, this is a point I've made a number of times, misogyny in politics doesn't just mean determining who you support and who you oppose. These right wingers, they'd oppose AOC if she was a man based on the policies. But it has to do with how you oppose them, how joyous, gleeful you are in your attacks against them, your willingness to engage in violent and sexual rhetoric against them. That's very much influenced by misogyny. And we see that when it comes to AOC, a full grown woman, even Greta Thunberg, who is still literally a child, a young woman, they're willing to engage in this incredibly misogynistic way. This is a massive problem. If we're gonna do something about climate change, if we're gonna communicate about climate change, I don't have the solution right now, but it's something that we should start to think about in a serious fashion. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, candidate's gonna join us on the other side.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Time, if you were an incumbent, elected politician, especially in the House, you could expect to go many cycles necessarily without having a challenger. Sometimes in the general, but certainly in the primary season. Not so in this cycle, where more and more Democrats, including those fairly highly placed in the party, are finding themselves facing serious challenges. And Representative Nadler in New York's 10th district, he's the latest. And we've got his challenger joining us on the show now, Jonathan Herzog. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. We're going to talk about Nadler in just a little bit. I want to start off with your platform. You've got some information about some of the more fleshed out portions of your platform available, including the Freedom Dividend, Medicare for All, and democracy dollars. Can you give our audience an idea of why you've prioritized these policies, what they mean to you?
Absolutely. So the general idea is that we're going through a fundamental economic and technological shift, where even in New York's 10th district, in the world's financial capital, in the richest, most advanced society in our history, no one should be too poor to meet their basic needs. And right now, 16% of people live in poverty. And this is as 20% of our storefronts are closing and more jobs are being automated away. So that's why I'm running, and that's why I'm running on these policies to help move our society and especially in the 10th district forward.
And I believe this is your first run for office, correct?
That's right.
And so you had been working as a staffer for presidential candidate Andrew Yang when you decided to leave to launch this bid. What is it about this particular district, this particular incumbent, that made you feel like you needed to go now? In this case, this would be the race for you.
For sure. Well, it's just home for me. And the reason I moved back home and announced the run was I had moved out to Iowa to help build and organize Andrew Yang's campaign out there. And the Yang Gang caught fire and became a national movement. And he's now a top six presidential candidate. So the question just came up over and over. Well, how do we get the Humanity First platform and the Freedom Dividend through Congress? And the answer became, well, we got to run it ourselves to make it happen.
Okay. And Representative Nadler, he's been in Congress since back in 1992, this district for 6 years. Tell me about him as an incumbent. What is it about him in that position that you felt wasn't doing the job?
Sure. Well, again, it wasn't so much about him, but just the reality on the ground for tens of thousands of New Yorkers. The fact that one in six people in 2019 is living in poverty. The fact that tens of thousands of working class jobs are being automated away, where if you walk into a McDonald's in the 10th district, you're gonna see wall-to-wall automated iPads, and whether that be a CVS or any retail establishment around the city. Yeah. So it's the fundamental reality of life changing on the ground and leaving people behind.
So we care a lot at this network about campaign finance, and you can't avoid the fact that for Nadler, less than 10% of his funding comes from small individual donations. What is your philosophy for fundraising for your race?
Yes, the philosophy is very, very simple, which is that people matter more than money. And as you allude to, one of the key tenets of my run is democracy dollars, which is a fundamental reform of our campaign finance system to publicly finance our elections and put actually 100 democracy dollars in the hands of every New Yorker and every American to say once and for all that people matter more than money in our elections.
As a former Andrew Yang staffer, and you know, your platform having quite a bit of overlap in terms of policies with his, you mentioned earlier that he was a top six presidential candidate. Now, we talked earlier this week on the show about the fact that CNN actually like manipulated a graphic to leave him out and put Beto in, even though he was polling higher than Beto in that particular race. And I know that a lot of supporters of Andrew Yang feel like there's an effort by the media to minimize his candidacy. As a former insider, what do you feel about this issue?
Well, I have to say thank you to you for calling a spade a spade, and you know, being one of the forefront leaders and just calling out what was happening. but I mean, the reality was that the campaign was built from the ground up in long form interviews and podcasts and conversations. And it's just grown organically from there. So I can't say anything particularly surprising.
Now, we have multiple candidates in this race that I personally support a number of the ideas, some really innovative ones. Andrew Yang has a lot of really interesting ideas. As the primary continues, there's a little bit more tension. I know that both you and Andrew Yang support the Freedom Dividend. Bernie Sanders critiqued it earlier this week. What did you make of his critique?
Yeah, I think it's a really important conversation to be had. You know, in theory, the federal jobs guarantee and the Freedom Dividend are not mutually exclusive. We most definitely need to invest in new jobs, especially in energy and infrastructure. But I think one of the key differences is with the Freedom Dividend, you're putting resources and capital directly into people's hands, which itself would create thousands of new jobs in New York and hundreds of thousands around the country. And importantly, recognize a lot of the work that our market currently values at zero, mm-hmm. like motherhood and caring for an ailing parent and all the nurturing and caregiving jobs that are gonna become increasingly important in our economy.
Yeah. I did wanna ask you one more question. You're taking on Representative Nadler. He's a powerful Democrat. Have any of the Democratic Party organizations reached out to you about your candidacy yet?
That's interesting. No.
I would be on the watch. I think those calls might be coming. We'll see. In the past, they've been somewhat aggressive against people that that primary their strongly favored incumbent. So we'll have to see for you what sort of pushback you might reach. But Jonathan Herzog, thank you for joining us today, candidate in the primary for New York's 10th district. We appreciate you joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, military spending. Bernie Sanders called it out in a fiery speech way back in 1992. The numbers these days far worse than back then. We'll give you all you need to know after this. Take a look at this speech by Bernie Sanders way back in 1992, calling out insane, out of control military spending.
Sometimes I think that the people in this institution and in the White House are really losing contact and not knowing what's going on with the American people. In case you don't know, and you haven't seen the latest polls, the American people hold the President of the United States in contempt. They hold this institution in contempt. They hold the Republican Party in contempt. They hold the Democratic Party in contempt. They think that maybe, given all of the crises facing this country, it's about time that there was some bold leadership here and that this institution made some hard choices. And this is what the choice is about. We are spending $270 billion a year on the military. But we don't have a major enemy. I know it hurts your feelings. I know you're upset about it. I know you're hoping and praying that maybe we'll have another war. Maybe somebody will rise up. But it ain't happening. The Soviet Union doesn't exist. The Warsaw Pact is through. Who are you worried about? Iraq? Panama? Who are you worried about? I'll tell you who I'm worried about. I'm worried about the fact that our workers are seeing a decline in their standard of living. They want to see our industry be rebuilt. That's what they want to see. No more B-2 bombers, no more Star Wars. Let's make the quality products we need. Let's invest in American industry. No, I won't yield. The American people want to see our kids educated. They want a Head Start program. They want their kids to be able to go to college. They want to wipe out the fact that 5 million children in this country go to bed hungry. They want child care for their kids. They want decent education. Let's have the guts to give some leadership to this country. The Cold War's over. Let's reinvest in America. Let's support this amendment.
That just gives me so much energy. While we were watching this, Edwin commented, I think that guy should be president. I'm thinking that too. That was incredible. Obviously, 100% true. And appropriate and needed back in 1992, but it holds up better than any movie from 1992 does. I can guarantee that. Who are you worried about? Who are you worried about? And he lists, what are you worried about, Iraq? Well, they did eventually push for a war in Iraq. He said Panama, they kind of want one in Venezuela now. Like the same driving force that he identified back in 1992 that incensed him then. They did act on that. It still exists today. They still want to sell weapons. They still want to spend billions of dollars bombing Yemen or Syria or Afghanistan or God only knows where. The only thing that hasn't held up are the sheer numbers, because as bad as they were then, and he cited them, $270 billion a year, it is way, way higher than that, three times higher than that today, despite the fact that we still lack a major enemy. We still don't have anything approaching the enemies we've had back during World War II, the Cold War, even hypothetically then. And so he was right, he's even more right today. Let's talk a little bit about how they spend the money that they do, because these numbers are literally insane in every way. I just saw news yesterday that Trump is proposing, I guess it's good news, to cut the number of troops in Afghanistan down to less than 10,000. Because yes, today, like almost decades after we invaded, we still have 10,000 plus troops in Afghanistan. If you take a look at the numbers, let's take a look at this chart, year by year. In 2011, 10 years after 9/11, we had 110,000 troops there. There are people serving in Afghanistan today that weren't born when the terror attack that was used as a justification for the invasion actually happened. And did you know that it costs a lot of money to have that many soldiers perpetually stationed in Afghanistan? Up until March of 2019, the total military expenditure in Afghanistan was $760 billion. Officially $760 billion. Now, if while they were making the case to invade Afghanistan, if they told you or your parents, whoever was making the decisions back then, we're gonna spend $760 billion, we're gonna have soldiers there for decades, might have been a different story, the level of support that they had for that war. And man, the machine just keeps chugging along. This year, the Trump administration proposed $750 billion in official defense spending as part of its budget, as well as steep cuts to domestic programs in healthcare and education. I mean, you can't afford those things if you're gonna put all your money into defense, I guess. But honestly, on the other side, it's not that much better. The House Democrats, they responded with $733 billion a year. An increase in line with inflation in support for increases in domestic spending. So look, that side is good, but the House Democrats are still approving hypothetically $733 billion. What are we fighting? Martians? I mean, what, like futuristic Nazis? I mean, politically, yeah. But we're not fighting those things here. We're not engaged in massive wars around the world. There is no justification for the level of defense spending, but there is an explanation for the level of defense spending, and that has to do with lobbyists. Raytheon Chief Executive Thomas Kennedy said, "The world is still a very dangerous place." Dangerous perhaps, but not for corporate profits. His company received $27 billion in sales of military technology just last year. And he said, I know the Democrats and Republicans that I talk to recognize that. Well, I'm sure they do. After all, some of those $27 billion are gonna be sent back to them as checks, campaign finance. And look, it's one thing to focus on one executive, but if you take a look at the industry as a whole, the defense sector has spent a total of more than $1 billion on lobbying since 2009, employing between 700 to 1,000 lobbyists in any given year, which means that for all of our elected officials, senators and representatives, they're actually outnumbered by lobbyists for just the defense sector. Okay, they've been flanked on all sides, they're surrounded. That's the true military situation that we should be worried about. Yeah, it's just insane. And I know, look, obviously there's a lot of jobs in this defense spending. Hell, there's 1,000 lobbying jobs. And they'll always say, you know what, yes, we spend a lot of money, but it generates a lot of jobs. It does, but what if the money was put somewhere else? In 2011, a study by economists from the University of Massachusetts made this blindingly clear, saying military spending is the worst way to create jobs. Putting the same money into any other area, from infrastructure to transportation to alternative energy to healthcare or education, creates up to twice as many jobs as military spending does. So look, if you're not convinced by the fact that when we buy these bombs, we feel a need to use these bombs, and that results in people dying around the globe needlessly, if that doesn't convince you for humanitarian or empathy, if those sorts of concerns don't affect you, it's also incredibly wasteful pragmatically. It's good for the lobbyists, it's good for Raytheon and Boeing and Lockheed Martin and all of that. But in terms of its effect on the economy, it could be better spent randomly. Just use your expensive military technology, your planes, to drop the money over a major city, and you'll have a better economic return than what you get when you send it to these companies. And I want to give you just a couple of standout examples of how wasteful this spending actually is. Do you know the Future Combat System? You probably haven't heard of it, hasn't been talked about in the media for a long time. It was multiple systems, one of which was what they wanted to do was they wanted to have a way for a tank traveling up to like 30 or 40 kilometers an hour to shoot multiple shells at different trajectories so they all land at the same time on a target. Really impressive, right? I mean, how could they make that work? They couldn't, but it did take $19 billion in research before they figured out that they couldn't make it work. $19 billion. That's like a quarter of a year of public education for all Americans. We put it into a program, there's a good chance you never even heard of. The Star Wars program back in the 80s, you hear jokes about that every once in a while. Stephen Colbert will make a joke about it. You know what's not a joke? The amount of money they actually spent on it. We honestly don't even know how much, but we believe it's between $100 and $150 billion were spent on that program that is now, at best, a punchline in late night TV shows. But that number, as high as that is, that's nothing compared to some of the biggest programs that are still ongoing. The F-35 Lightning II, really impressive, technologically advanced plane. It is believed that since 1996, that program alone, they've spent $1.5 trillion on it. And look, that, like, you almost have to laugh at that amount. I mean, trillions. You could have gotten a tax cut for the wealthy for $1.5 trillion. So when they talk about climate change and how we can't afford it, just think of the Lightning II. What's most ironic about that plane is for $1.5 trillion, you'd think we could invade another galaxy with that technology. But no, it's actually plagued with any number of issues. It was considered outdated when they finally rolled it off the assembly line. In tests against planes that we have, that we've had for decades, it actually loses in dogfights. Apparently has a big problem, the Lightning II, with being struck by lightning, ironically enough, as if God himself is mocking us for our hubris. $1.5 trillion. Now, we should be talking about these numbers. We should be talking about the fact that the Pentagon buried an internal study that exposed $125 billion in administrative waste because it thought Congress might use that as an excuse to cut the defense budget, which is both insulting and corrupt, but also laughable because there's no chance the current Congress is gonna cut defense spending, no matter what study you find. Look, these numbers are crazy. We need to continue talking about them. But thank God we have people like Bernie Sanders in office who've been talking about it for literally decades. Back for when I was born, he was talking about this issue and he continues to. We would be very lucky to have him in charge of this budget. So we'll be looking out for that. Anyway, crazy numbers. Oh boy. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, Ken Klippenstein is gonna join us to break down his most recent reporting on detention centers after this. Over the past year or so, popular protests against private prisons, these detention centers, the network of concentration camps that we've got set up along the border and throughout the country, they've been growing. Opposition to these organizations, the waste of money, the unethical behavior, and the companies that run them, they're starting to feel the pressure. And one CEO of the GEO Group, this is George Zoli, wrote an internal email that was leaked to TYT that said that Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the Jewish activist group Never Again Action are misguided individuals who defamed the American flag. So GEO Group CEO, not a fan of these protests, went on to say, this is actually a spokesperson, said, organizations that have threatened our employees or taken violent action against our company have also directly used the same terminology as Representative Ocasio-Cortez, including concentration camp. I would argue they've used the same terminology because it's 100% true. Now, she has responded to this attack from the GEO Group, tweeting, if there's any CEO in the country that I'd be honored to go toe-to-toe with, the CEO of the largest for-profit private prison corporation would definitely be up there. Guess what, GEO Group? Your entire business, the caging of humans for profit, is immoral and should be outlawed, which is strong. And you know, inject that sort of attack against them right directly into my veins. Joining us now on the program is the man responsible for this story being a story in the first place. This is a senior investigative reporter for TYT Investigates, Ken Klippenstein. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, man. Great to be on here.
How's it going? So you got those internal emails leaked to you. You got the AOC bump on your story. You've got to be feeling good for the hard work that you've done. So tell me about this story, about what was revealed by these internal emails.
I think that what it showed was that the CEO is furious about not just AOC, but the movement behind her that is really standing up in the form of protests, but also public rhetoric too. To the practices of these ICE facilities. If you look through the email, and I link to it in the story, it's very strong language, especially for the CEO of the largest prison company in the country. You know, these folks tend to be little more self-regulated in terms of how they come off and professionalism. So I think he was, I think they're feeling the heat, like you said.
So this was intended to be an internal email sent to people inside of the company. We can't know for sure, but what does it seem like the objective of this was? I mean, it couldn't just have been to vent to his employees.
Well, I can tell you that the reason that my source provided it to me was because they were outraged at just the overt political posturing within the email. If you read it, it seems very clear that he's trying to get his employees to think that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is opposed to their material interests and coming after them in some way. Of course, she's coming after the institution, you know, of how immigration is being prosecuted under this administration, and then also the conditions at these facilities. But of course, she doesn't have any animus for workers or anything like that.
Yeah, certainly not. She's standing up for them more than their CEO ever will. In the letter, the GO executive states that they have never been involved in criminal justice or immigration laws, like sort of implying that there is this like hard line between them, the recipients of the funds, and the actual crafting of the legislation. Is that true?
Which is preposterous. I mean, they this was attached to the email that was sent to some employees, and it includes a kind of like list of here's what we do and here's what we don't do. And it was a very, you know, PR speak kind of thing. And you can't help but laugh if you know the slightest bit about immigration policy and what these things said. So to answer your question, you know, that's extremely disingenuous. They contribute huge sums of money, mostly to Republicans, but also specifically to President Trump, his inaugural committee. And they spend enormous amounts of money lobbying on homeland security issues, detention issues. So I have no idea where they got that from, if the person who said it believed it.
Now, the protests against the treatment of detainees, the conditions in these different facilities, isn't constrained to just one corporation. There are multiple corporations that control them. But while we're on the subject of GEO Group, what do we know about the actual conditions inside of their facilities, the ones that they manage?
Well, I would agree with AOC in what she said, which when she visited CBP facilities, she called them, quote, horrifying. And that's something that's not just borne out, you know, by her. Of course, she's a Democrat. This is borne out by the Department of Homeland Security's Inspector General, who actually investigated these conditions and themselves found that they were shockingly bad. And you can read that report. It's public. It was put out very recently. I think this is actually came around the same time as AOC's visit and this email. But, you know, I want to stress that is the federal government themselves, essentially a component of the DHS, who has obviously an interest in, you know, having these facilities. You know, these are huge contracts they have with them. And so even their own investigators found that the conditions were abysmal.
Exactly, including I saw there's a reference to nooses in detainee cells, inadequate detainee medical care.
In the report.
Exactly.
That's literally in the executive summary of the report. It's not some kind of, you know, activist or something. It's just, it's shocking, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Now, there's a reference in the letter saying that their facilities have never been overcrowded or housed unaccompanied minors. Do we know whether or not that's true? I find it hard to believe, but what do we actually know?
No, it doesn't pass the laugh test. They are very proud in the email, like we adhere to the Obama-Biden standards. And specifically in that DHS report I was just telling you about, they specifically say that those standards are not met.
Yeah. Now, there's one last thing. This goes a little bit outside of the bounds of this story alone, but the CEO made reference to the sorts of language that are used by the activists and AOC. And I've noticed that, especially since El Paso, there's been this renewed focus on the dangerous language on the right that seems to encourage terror attacks. This feels to me like a both sidesing, like, oh, AOC said that we're bad, our corporation's bad, and that's the same thing. She's calling us concentration camps. That's mean. What are your thoughts about that? Do you think that there might be a sort of equivalence being made here on that?
No, I don't think so. AOC has always been very clear that you know, she supports peaceful protests and opposition to these groups. And I want to add, I think that's dangerous to essentially instruct employees in the general public to believe that these violent attacks are because of an elected official. especially when the elected official, there's no indication that she's ever supported any sort of political violence. So I think that's very dangerous.
I couldn't agree more. Ken, as always, thank you so much for your hard work in breaking this story. It's only news because of what you did. I'm glad that AOC helped to signal boost it as well. Is there a way that people can get in touch with you if they have information?
Yeah, I always encourage people, reach out. You can hit me on Signal at 202-510-1268. That encrypts the messages, and it's an important part of source protection. So if anyone has a tip about immigration generally, please reach me at that number.
Ken Klippenstein, thank you as always.
Thanks a lot, man.
We're gonna take a short break here. We come back a little bit more to close out the week. Every once in a while, the social media activity of Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez gets just a little bit spicy, and we had an instance of that in the past 24 hours over, in fact, her Twitter account. She was called out on Twitter by the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, who tweeted at her late yesterday. Knight Columbia sent this letter to AOC urging her not to block Twitter users on the basis of viewpoint. I'm not gonna go through the whole letter, but I have read it. And what they're effectively arguing is because recently a court ruled that Donald Trump could not block Twitter users, she should be held to the exact same standard. Now, they needlessly add in that she's blocking them based on the basis of viewpoint, which she will respond to. I have no idea why they've included that. And she would say that her at AOC account is not her official account. It's not her representative account. It's her personal account, so she can do whatever she wants. They don't accept that, and the court doesn't seem to either. And all of this is based on the fact that Donald Trump has decided not to use at POTUS, and he has instead decided to make an official government channel out of his personal Twitter account. So to some extent, he's ruined it for everybody. But she did respond to what they said, tweeting, "I have 5.2 million followers, less than 20 accounts are blocked for ongoing harassment, zero are my constituents. Number two, harassment is not a viewpoint. Some accounts like the Daily Caller posted fake nude photos of me and abused my comments to spread it. No one is entitled to abuse." And so I would add, you could say if she gets harassed, she could mute them. But the thing is, if someone is spreading fake information, violent rhetoric, sexual rhetoric like that outlet did when they decided to try to make money off of fake nude photos of her, and they add her in it, she, whether she wants to or not, is not just being harassed, she has to be a part of the harassment. They are exploiting her to some extent by being able to tag her in that. Now, an easy solution to this would be, okay, you can't, as an official government official, you can't block them, but Twitter needs to actually take seriously this sort of harassment. That's not the world we live in, though. Unfortunately, Twitter is not gonna take this sort of thing seriously, and women, especially in media and politics, entertainment, they are harassed brutally, and there's almost never any consequences. So that's the world we actually live in. And she goes on to say, "People are free to speak whatever classist, racist, false, misogynistic, bigoted comments they'd like. They do not have the right to force others to endure their harassment and abuse." And I think that we can all understand that sentiment. All of us except Laura Ingraham, though, who decided to add this, fewer than 20 accounts, because the issue she has is that AOC said less than 20 accounts rather than fewer, which makes her either the biggest fan of Stannis Baratheon that I know of, or just kind of an a-hole in this particular case. I'm sure that she is harassed, that she receives death threats and rape threats. She is, after all, a woman on the internet, but that's what she decided to add. Now, thankfully, AOC decided to go unfiltered in response to Laura Ingraham. So she quote retweeted saying, "See, you're a neo-Nazi fan favorite, and I don't block you for defending white supremacist viewpoints and mocking gun violence survivors." Which is a devastating point. It's both 100% accurate about Laura Ingraham, and also true that she clearly does not go around willy-nilly blocking people for their political viewpoints. She just has chosen in limited cases to block people who have tried to rope her in to her own harassment. Now, at the end of the day, I don't know if she has the legal right to actually do that. If a judge has decided that public officials have to not block people, then fine, that should be applied equally to Republicans and to Democrats. But social media outlets like Twitter have to take this more seriously, especially considering the credible death threats against this particular representative. Okay, thank you everybody for watching. Before we go, we close out the week, I do want to read just a couple of the comments that you guys have left, reviews on iTunes. I love it when you guys do that. When you leave a 5-star review, when you leave a comment, it really helps the podcast for more people to discover it. We've got a great core audience, but we do want more people to see it. And you guys help us when you leave comments like this. Connor Delaney just yesterday left a comment saying, John's analysis of current events in the political landscape of the country and world is unmatched. Backing up his segments with reliable statistical data and clearly doing his research before reporting is why I love the show. He has a bright, bright future in front of him. Thank you, Connor, for saying that. Let's see, there was another positive. Donor Don of Division says, this show is intelligent, thoughtful, and dedicated to telling the truth about what is happening in the world today. That's actually our mission statement. Johnny Roll is up there with Chris Hayes in explaining the nuance of various issues and has a total grasp on the concept of his own potential bias in covering any particular story. His frequent co-hosts Brooke Thomas and J.R. Jackson also adds top-notch voices that are not often enough heard on most news programs. 5 stars. Thank you, Don, for saying that. And a special shout out to Truthful Jay, who said, this is guy is one of the least intelligent people in news. I think he's implying that I'm Jewish. That's like the anti-Semitic thing. I'm not. Not that there would be anything wrong with that. Weird. Anyway, thank you for watching all week. We'll see you on Monday. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adarola. I'll see you soon.